is how we roll.
Dr. Kevin Lim is better known as at Brain Opera on Twitter and the man behind TheoryIsTheReason.com. He's got a keen interest in the co-evolution of networking and network and culture, and his research has ranged from control and anti-control in internet-regulated China to social capital among online non-profit organizations. He currently works at the National Art Gallery as the assistant director in strategy and experience. Hi, I'm Sarah Cheng DeWin, and you're listening to Raw and Ready on 938 Live, the talk show that digs deep with you who've been there, done that, and Kevin Lim. Kevin Lim is kicking off our series on youth bloggers. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah.
At 34 years old, Kevin has not only been there, done that, but he's also made an effort for everyone to experience exactly what he's been through and done. Through a social cyber experiment in 2007, we find out more from Kevin about this particular experience, as well as his views on the internet, culture, among, you know, other very academic questions. What can I say? Be prepared for a very complex evening.
I know. I hope it's not too crazy. Okay.
I hope so too. You know, Kevin, you actually were known and you had a lot of attention from being a social cyborg. I mean, okay, the definition of this is kind of varies from different people to different people and different dictionaries. Can you define for us what being a social cyborg means?
Well, in essence, actually, today, a lot of us, any of us who spend a lot of time on the internet, what I call the permanent residents of the internet, could be considered social cyborgs. And the reason why is because if you think about the iPhones and the Android phones you carry along with us, they really serve as appendages, like the extra sensory abilities of our human, you know, our human being, our human body. Most of us can't live without it anymore. We depend on it to stay connected with so many people. And what I try to do is to take it even further with my social cyborg experiment.
And what you did was that you put cameras all around your body, and I read the blog post about it, and you were trying to find ways to reduce the visibility of the camera,
right.
And find ways of hiding it, and getting different angles. Can you share more about that experience? Why did you go into it in the first place?
Sure. Part of it's also because of the influence of people around me. Back when I studied in the University of Buffalo, my professor was very much into this sort of thing as well. And over in Toronto, there was a cyborg named Steve Mann, and he was experimenting with this way back in the 90s. So it's nothing new. What I was trying to do is basically to be as lazy as possible. Because
lazy?
Yeah, because if you think about it, a lot of us might be blogging today, okay? And it takes time. You have to compose what you want to say. You have to sit down by a computer or your iPhone or whatever, post a picture, leave comments, write the whole story of what happened. And in a way, what I was trying to do is to skip all that. Just strap on a camera, or several if you have more, and just let your whole life be broadcasted online.
So instead of like reporting it through words, you just wanted to use the videos to speak for themselves.
Right.
We are taking calls tonight at 669-11938 if you have a question for Kevin on his experiences with this social cyborg thing. But of course, he's also kind of an expert on how culture and technology collide. Do give us a call at 669-11938, and also you can leave us a comment on Facebook at facebook.com/rawandready. So your social cyborg project was in 2007. How come it stopped?
Well, I wanted to be lazy, but the thing is that when I tried this on, it took up quite a lot of resources. First, I had to develop a backpack with enough battery to last at least half a day. The cameras and everything, sometimes they would knock off, they would fail. I needed to carry a very small computer along with me. And so I was literally carrying a lot of electrical devices all around me. Well, it's very difficult, actually. And when it rains, it does get very dangerous. So it's not very wise to stand around me when I'm fully switched on. Yeah, I
mean, like a robot.
In a way, it's like what Iron Man, you know, did in the movies, right? All of us dream to be more than what we're capable of. You know, there's this godlike tendency that we might have. And so this is just a cheap DIY way of setting it up. We want to use what's existing out there. We want to extend our abilities beyond what nature might offer us. And so this, in a way, this is, in a way, it's kind of like magical. It's telepathy. It's cognition all rolled into one. It's the hive mind, because when you broadcast your life, people can all talk about what you're doing. There was an experiment I did where I was choosing between two cereal brands in the shopping mall, in a supermarket store, and you know, I asked people, which one should I pick? And people could tweet me, and I would just pick the one that they choose. So it helps with decision making.
It was real time.
Yeah, it's real time. And it's very much the idea of what if you lived your whole life on the internet and let many thousands of people out there who might be following you take control of it. It's sort of like the cyber version of a medium that we see today, where behind my one lens could be 1,000 eyes. So it can get pretty freaky. It turns people away, and that's why I try to hide it as much as possible. But overall, it's a pretty interesting experience.
You didn't get to the point where how you stopped.
How I stopped? It got
was
too
it just
exciting.
Because it was the resources that were just too many costs involved?
Yeah, at some point, it got pretty crazy. The next thing I wanted to acquire was some sort of LCD monocle I could wear over my eyes so I could see the whole world, like, partly through a display. But, yeah, it got pretty expensive, and it's quite a lot of work. So it failed my lazy test, and so I couldn't sustain it too much longer. And
it didn't actually achieve the
while.
Objective of doing less. You yes. were doing quite a lot more.
Yes, I was hoping for a single solution, but it didn't work out. So now I turn to things like Instagram and all that, because keeps it simple.
You also put this on a blog, and that, I think, was one of the avenues that everybody was following this project on. Mm-hmm. How did you start blogging?
Oh, okay. So there is an impetus, a reason behind it. Back in 2000, I had just moved to the States to study, and I didn't think that I would spend so much time over there, but I did. So I wanted an easy way to let everyone know, friends and family back home know what I was doing. I didn't want to have to call each person and tell them what's going on. So I just, you know, again, lazy. Lazy.
I was going to say that.
Yeah, it is a virtue. My prof also says that. And just by publishing once, it goes everywhere. And it's amazing. You know, people come back to me and say, hey, I saw that you did this and that. Well, awesome. You actually read my blog. So, yeah, it works out.
You actually blogged, so first of all, because you were lazy, you want to let everybody know. But you started blogging, I mean, beyond what you were doing, but, you know, putting up more thought-provoking pieces and, you know, sharing, you know, other, you know, thought leaders' views. Mm. How did that evolution come about?
I believe it's what we called the side effect. What I was doing back in university was pretty interesting. And, you know, sometimes when you study something, you look at what's happening out in the real world, there could be things that you could say about what's happening based on what you've been studying. And so I just put two and two together, and I wanted a place to share my thoughts, because this was exactly what I was studying anyway.
So what exactly were you studying?
It was
a BA in communication, and then you ended up doing a PhD, right?
Right.
And you dissected on the relationship between censorship and something to do with the politics and the involvement of people in China.
Right.
So how did that happen? Because you weren't always blogging about, you know, your dissertation or
It's everything that's got to do with in a sense cyber culture, whether it's gadgets or anything that changes the very social fabric of communities, introducing a particular piece of technology, a new policy, things like that impact how our lives get changed. Clay Shirky, he's a technologist. He's written several books as an academic. And one of my favorite quotes from him is, technology doesn't get socially interesting until it gets boring. And what he's trying to say with that was pretty insightful. He was saying that, you know, when something new comes out, everyone clamors for it. And
like,
you know,
iPad 2.
iPad 2.
Which you had,
I
saw.
Yes, unfortunately. that's one of the things. What's interesting is that when it gets into the hands of the everyday person, the aunties, the assholes, and they start taking very interesting pictures of their daily lives, that's where you really get really interesting stuff. People lose their iPhones when they post a picture online. You know, they make a report of like, oh, this is my phone, I lost it. If anyone else can find it, that'd be awesome. That's the sort of thing that, communities out there can sort of like help out, and it works out that way.
So it's when the technology goes into the masses.
Right.
We're going to continue this conversation with Kevin in a very short while. We have to go to traffic. But do give us a call at 66911938 because Kevin would love to chat with you. Right, Kevin?
Right.
We're on Ready on 938 Live with me, Sarah Ching. The Wind continues in just a moment.
Turn on the heat because we're raw and ready on 938 Live.
We're on Ready this evening with Kevin Lim. He calls himself a cyberculturalist, this very difficult word to pronounce. But he's also known as Brain Opera on Twitter, and he's a man behind theory.istthereason.com. And Kevin was, you know, telling us about how, you know, when technology gets into the hands of the masses, you know, what is captured with that gets pretty interesting. And he was also telling me off air, you know, what his experience was like studying overseas in Buffalo, New York. And you were there for 9 years, Kevin. That's a really long time to be away. What was that experience like for you? And how did that actually, you know, move you, I mean, towards different perspectives coming out of Singapore?
Right. Very interestingly, I was actually very happy being in Singapore. I didn't actually plan to go abroad, but my mom had the foresight to say, you know, you should really go out and further your studies. So I said, okay, fine. I went to look around, and the university had a pretty nice program. They were pretty welcoming to Singaporeans. And I took it up, did my BA in communications for 1.5 years, because they really take in a lot of credits from poly education and all that. What's interesting after that was that, you know, I used to do a bit of web design, so they learned that I had some web design skill. I ran, in the past, substitute.com, which was a music portal, and from there, they hired me to work on campus, and they paid for my tuition. So I did my master's and PhD, all with school fees taken care of by the university.
Was it mainly because you had the skill, or for some other reasons?
I would think it's the skill, but when I spoke to a lot of my colleagues over there, they liked Singaporeans a lot because of, in a sense, we're pretty diligent with our work, we're pretty hardworking, and they like to actually, they kind of like give us opportunities, and they actually, such as graduate assistantships, undergrad funding and all that. So there's actually, what I'm trying to say is that there's actually a lot of opportunities to study abroad where you don't have to spend too much money. You kind of still have to start off with a, you know, degree, but later on you can find opportunities where they'll fund you and all that. Yeah.
Call us at 669-11938 if you'd like to ask Kevin a question about his experiences, many very interesting experiences. And your dissertation was on online censorship and about protest groups in China.
Right.
And you have this, you know, online for everybody to view, and I tried to read the first, like, 1.1, and I couldn't finish it, man. It was really deep. I mean, share with us, what are some of the major insights that you found in this research?
Okay, so first of all, I never planned to do my PhD. It's really for my parents. But,
Mama, are you hearing that?
Yeah, but it works out. I mean, it works out in the end, especially coming back to Singapore, it worked out. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about my dissertation, right? First of all, it's a pretty interesting topic. A lot of people always talk about China and the Great Firewall, they call it, how, you know, there's a lot of censorship and all that going on. And basically, one of the things that I found was that it can only last so long. There are many factors that control how societies manage themselves. And if you look at society today in China, they're actually, in some ways, more liberal than in the US.
In what way?
For example, okay, to put it very simply, there are many elements to society. Political control, they might not have had so much political rights, but the government grants them a lot of individual creativity, a lot of personal freedoms. In the States, for instance, we might have religious you know, different kind of issues where some states are more controlling of gay and lesbian rights, for instance. But in China, it's not so much the case. They might liberalize those issues, but then take control of others. So there's a give and take situation. There's a tit for tat going on in places like China and even Taiwan. And that's how they negotiate it. They make that choice. So it's interesting that way.
And we are having a conversation about Kevin Lim's dissertation. What is, like, one other key insight you found between the relationship of online censorship and protest groups in China?
Well, we found that if you look at what happened in Egypt not too long ago, there were online protest groups that were organized online. It's very much the case where these systems can only do so much. At some point, there's a breaking point, and these ideas of how you actually form these protests can actually happen pretty systematically. It's been replicated in other countries where it's also developing or oppressed, there are oppressed governments and all that. So what's interesting is, we see that these technological rules don't work as well. It needs to be supported by legal restrictions, and that's how China does it so well. They have a lot of legal control over their citizens.
Mm. Yeah. And we have to stop here for now, but we will continue after the headline news with Kevin Lim, Raw and Ready on 938 Live.
Raw. Ready. This is how we roll.
Brain Opera on Twitter is also known as Dr. Kevin Lim, or the other way around. He's the man behind TheoryIsTheReason.com, and after extensive press coverage of his social cyborg experience, he's gone on to work at the National Art Gallery as the Assistant Director in Strategy and Experience. And we were talking earlier about his dissertation on online censorship and protest groups in China. And, you know, we were wondering, just over the off-air conversation we were having, how this could be applied to Singapore in terms of the findings between the online community and how online actions are translated into real-world action.
Mm. Well, some of the events that happen in China, for example, the earthquake situation or the train derailment, these things could cause, you know, certain... If the government doesn't respond to it positively, people take matters in their own hands. They start to form protest groups online, and then they take it into the streets and so on. So there are certain situations that cause these breaking points to occur, or might be called the tipping point. In Singapore, however, we live largely in status quo. Most of the things that we experience here are life is generally good. You know, we don't experience so much turbulence in that sense. But what's interesting is that the situation has sort of liberated in a sense that as our government becomes more active participants online, whether be it on Facebook and so on and so forth, people start to have less fear or inhibition approaching them, talking about them, and engaging in politics more so than before. So in the past, some of the youth forums that I've gone to, they talk about this aspect of the grey area where they might be unsure whether or not they're allowed to say something, and so they don't say it at all. But now it doesn't seem to be an issue at all. So
are you sure? I think there's some. I believe there must be still some grey areas.
I'm sure.
What do you think they could be? Of course, with this is general elections, everybody is using, you know, Twitter and Facebook to say, and pass on election results. Mm-hmm. Aren't there other grey areas that you still come across in your conversations, now?
There would certainly be. But it seems to be the case that, especially with the government taking on a light touch approach, it's very encouraging in the sense that people are allowed to talk about certain things and always have that three strike rule to the extent. If someone says something and, you know, it doesn't intentionally mean it, usually it's not something that would send them off to jail or something immediately. They might, you know, get a warning and so on and so forth. So that's what I've seen so far from my participation in some of the discussions that has happened regarding internet regulation online in Singapore. And I don't see that inhibition so much anymore, especially with sites like Stomp and all that. You start to see more of people conducting what we call surveillance. Surveillance is top authority looking down at you, and surveillance is where people below look up and watch the watchdogs. Mm. So it's interesting. There's this effect where everybody's sort of regulating one another. I don't know if that's a good thing, but it might lead to a more equal standing at the end, more democracy.
We're having a conversation with Kevin Lim, and you can call in to 669-11938, as Kevin will be most happy to answer your questions about what he feels about the progression of, you know, where technology is moving us and how that relates to, you know, our everyday lives. You were also talking to me earlier on about, why is it that on the internet, which we all spend so much time on right now, Google, Facebook and YouTube are services that, you know, happen for free, and how this relates to the notion of cloud labor. Can you explain for us what this means?
Oh, yeah, sure. early on, especially when Facebook and Google search and all that first came about, people were asking, how is this free? How did they actually make money off it? And what are we actually giving back in return? One of the easiest answers might be, it's advertising.
Of course.
But that's, yeah, but that fuels a lot of the publishing industry. That's almost an understood kind of situation. What makes the internet different, though, is that as we use these services more and more, these services get to what we call data mine, or search for very important, very interesting information about you and your friends that you talk to. That's in turn used for other things. Okay, let me give you an example. On Facebook, when we start to post pictures online, we tag our friends and so on, Facebook then has a very complete dossier of what your network looks like, what your friends look like, it's actually enforcing what's called cloud labor, or crowdsourcing in a way, because who else would be better to label these pictures than your network of friends? These pictures, if they're unsearchable, become essentially quite useless online. If you can't find it, it's non-existent. So by having people distribute this work amongst themselves, it becomes an enjoyable activity to some extent, but it becomes serious assets for companies like Facebook.
So, yeah. So everybody, you know, tags their own friends, and you're saying that basically we're all working for Facebook for free.
In a way, yes.
Oh my gosh, that is a scary thought. How about, you know, the other aspects of, you know, YouTube and Google? I mean, those don't have, you know, tagging systems, or do they? I mean, we tag videos according to categories and things like that, but nothing so much like image recognition.
To some extent, those things are sort of being experimented on. There are services that sort of can identify faces already in images automatically and in videos as well. I've seen some examples. But what's interesting is that the more we use these services, the more legitimacy we're adding to it, the network effect, we call it. It's kind of like how fax machines work. They don't just work on their own. They require a whole network of people to use them in order to be effective. So the more of us using it, the more legitimacy we're adding to it, and the more labor we give back to these services, whether it's subconsciously or distributed fashion, such that we don't feel that it's actually work, but it's actually fun in a way.
But what are the long-term implications for normal people like me? Okay, you are not normal, but for me, you know, I am a normal person, and I type my friends on Facebook. Is there any harm?
No, I don't see any harm in that. What I'm just trying to highlight, or through some of the experiences I've seen so far, some of the discussions that I've seen so far, is that we do have to ask this question of whether what's happening on social networks, or this so-called virtual sweatshops that are happening, whether we're aware of it. What implications does it have down the road? Right now, we might not be aware of this labor we're performing and what kind of impact it has, but what I'm trying to say is I think a lot of academics out there are questioning, what are the implications of this? There are some services, like the Amazon Mechanical Turk, that turn it around its head, because you might have a piece of work that it's very rudimentary and it's very laborious or tedious, but if you distribute it enough to enough people, it could be easy. What Amazon Turk does is that you could be issuing a penny for every little task that you assign someone to do, like sketch a little sheep or something, and you might end up with an artwork of 100 or 1,000 sheeps. And that's something that's, you know, laborious for you to do, but on the internet, because it's distributed, it could be fun. So there was an artist, he did this as a performance art where he used Mechanical Turk to generate this sheep art, and he's made pretty good headway.
Definitely cloud sourcing and cloud everything is the way forward at the moment in technology. Having a conversation with Kevin Lim, and I'm going to talk more about his existing work at the National Art Gallery, and that has a lot to do with data as well. And we continued in just a moment. Stay with us, Ron Ready on 938 Live.
Are you ready for the future? Because we're it. Raw and Ready on 938 Live.
And Kevin Lim is very raw because he moved out of the technology sphere into the real world finally as the National Art Gallery's Assistant Director for Strategy and Experience. So you were saying that, for your Chinese dissertation, and how, you know, online action has to sometimes translate into real world action. But now you are moving your application of data analysis from the internet and technology into the physical world. How exactly, has your experience with, you know, technology and its association with culture, how does that apply to your current work right now?
Okay, I can give you one example. There's been several interesting work in this area right now because museums seems to be the last frontiers to some extent.
Frontiers of?
In a sense that if you look at other public institutions out there, like the libraries and all that, it's very understood how they engage the public. You know, they come in, they transact in terms of loaning books, participating in programs and so on and so forth. So it's understood and it's a very popular activity to go to the library and hang out and so on. But for museums, especially in Singapore, it's quite a different phenomenon. We don't see as much locals visiting as we hope, in a sense. In other countries, you see like a lot of locals visiting their own museums besides the tourists. So it works out. How I apply my background in studying how internet users behave is that in the past, early 90s and so on, people might have web pages, not blogs, but web pages and so on. And so the experience is very passive. Right now with blogs and Facebook and all that, it's very active. You can go online and comment very easily or upload pictures and all that. Now, for the museum setting, it's also very understood that it used to be a very passive experience. You look at paintings, artifacts, and so on, and you didn't have to walk away thinking,
can't comment. You can't write on a painting and say, I don't like this.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the problem. So I've basically come back to take on this job to try and see if I can make the museum more social. In a way, what if the museum were to be a physical Facebook? Everything that you see, from the artwork to the artifacts to even the programs you're trying out, or even the other visitors who are there, what if everything there became a social object that you can tag, comment, or even interact with to some extent, or even remix?
What are some specific strategies that you're looking at right now?
So some examples might be community-curated galleries, for instance. So most of the time, museums have this sense of being atas, right? You only have the elitists, the rich with the paintings, or the curators with high education, understanding the works there, and so on and so forth. But what about the common layman? How do we get them engaged? We have to give them opportunities where they can participate or even vote, for instance. Everything from simple things like voting on favorite artworks, so we have a ranking, or even suggesting certain paintings that we should acquire, and so on and so forth. There are a myriad of activities that we could develop. But what's interesting is that we're trying to figure out how to engage the public more, get them more involved, more conscious of it, and things like even recommending paintings from, you know, that you, based on what you like.
Were able to vote for the paintings they wanted to have in the exhibition, how would that change the notion of what art is?
Yeah, I mean, art is very much what is in the eye of the beholder. We kind of understand it to some extent like that, but there's also a value that museums place on art itself. We understand which pieces might have more historic value. There's a whole movement that the curators might understand that most people might not. And so this slowly translates to the everyday person as they get more and more involved. They start to understand the processes involved. What do curators actually do when they select pieces of artwork and so on and so forth?
So you're saying that in the process of getting people to vote, they could be at the same time educated?
They're learning at the same time. So.
Yeah. And you know, there's this video on YouTube, right? And you talk a lot about how you use data and, tools for data. Where does this come in all the strategy?
It's very much like how when you run a blog or a website, you want to track how visitors behave on a certain blog or website. Where are they clicking? What are they doing? What we're doing is we're applying that to the museum context. We're observing how visitors behave around specific artworks to try and determine where are the hot spots in the museum. Why is this particular painting more popular than the others?
Where are you getting your data from right now? Because the National Art Gallery is all boarded up.
Right. We have certain exhibitions that we're running at the Singapore Art Museum. And right now we have the Liu Kang exhibition that's going on. And what we do is basically we have human observers for now watching how people behave. It's random sampling, of course. You can't do it all the time. But down the road, with certain pieces of technology that we will employ in the future museum, we will be able to do this in an automated way to see how people behave, where they hang out, and so on and so forth. So then we can better understand what people actually like, want, and we could recommend artwork to them as well.
So any closing thoughts you have about the future, you know, of data management and as well as strategy in terms of your, you know, your existing knowledge of technology and human behavior?
I think down the road, as more and more of us start to participate in using all these internet tools and all that, even posting pictures on Stomp, writing comments, going on Facebook and all that, we are, in our sense, we are learning to be our own curators. We are learning to look at the world up there and become the organic filters. We are telling people what's important and what's not. So, especially when you have so many of us doing it, it becomes quite a legitimate form of journalism, I think, even.
And it seems like everybody's going to be more and more fragmented then, don't you think?
Well,
as we increasingly be our own personalized curators and see what we want to see only, and the internet and all the web is wanting to give us only what we want. I mean, customization is huge right now.
Huge.
Everything is going to break up soon.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, one of the things is that we start to discover who's very much like us out there. So,
A whole new topic for a whole different day. Thank you so much for being with us here on Raw and Ready and 98 Live, Kevin.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Once again, you can see Kevin's work when the gallery opens in 2015. Sounds far away, but Kevin's working very hard. You've been listening to Raw and Ready on 98 Live, the talk show that digs deep with young people who've been there, done that. And to suggest guests or topics or to connect with previous guests like Kevin, you can log on to facebook.com/rawandready. Next week, we speak to the best friends forever behind Juicy and Delicious as we continue our series on youth bloggers. Till next week, stay Raw and Ready. For 98 Live, I'm Sarah Cheng Dewin.
Raw. Ready. This is how we roll.